Hello, I'm Malcolm Bernstein. This is the American Israelite program, The News of the Jews. My mother was a Hadassah lady, and apparently Hadassah has fallen on slow times, and they're making a comeback. A decade after Bernie Madoff's debacle, one so serious that Hadassah officials refused to even utter the Ponzi schemer's name, the Women's Zionist Organization is back. The finances are robust. 2017 tax returns show $108 million in assets and a staff of about 200 works at its New York headquarters and 8 regional offices. To build membership, Hadassah is targeting younger women, recognizing that the stay-at-home mothers who made Hadassah Lady a cliché in the post-war years are now professionals balancing work and home lives along with a dedication to Israel. And last year, Hadassah reopened its office in Washington, banking that one key to growth is navigating a middle political ground in a polarized age. The organization's key success so far has been signing co-sponsors for the Never Again Education Act, which would finance grants to public and private middle and high schools to help develop teachers and improve Holocaust education programs. Working with the Jewish Federations of North America, Hadassah's Washington lobbyist, Karen Pikel-Borelli, has signed on 251 members of the U.S. House of Representatives and 10 in the Senate since the measure was introduced in the latter body last month. The bill's broad appeal is no coincidence. Hadassah CEO Janice Weinman said it gets the largest reaction response from the membership. Pekin Baral is a good fit for its bipartisan mission. She was a political appointee in the President George W. Bush State Department Anti-Semitism Monitoring Office, and then for a number of years was director of the Mid-Atlantic Advocacy for the Orthodox Union. The latter job required cultivating the Democratic majority legislatures that typify East Coast states. Karen has been instrumental in our congressional outreach, Weinman said. On Friday, following 2 weeks of partisan warfare in Washington on what it means to be pro-Israel, culminating with President Donald Trump's jibe that Jews who vote Democratic are disloyal to the Jewish state, Hadassah put out a call for bipartisanship. The group said pitting people and parties against one another will sacrifice the goal of respect for diversity and coexistence. Hadassah is committed to the bedrock values of our two nations and urges our leaders to end the politicization of this essential relationship. Harder still may be keeping an increasingly polarized Jewish electorate on board. The group's Israel agenda tacks slightly to the right, endorsing bills targeting the Boycott Israel movement, bills that left-wing Democrats reject as infringing on free speech rights. Hadassah also advocates for changes in Palestinian textbooks considered anti-Israel. On the left, the group advocates for reproductive rights and its state chapters are organized protests against increasingly restrictive abortion laws. Hadassah's language on reproductive rights will never please most Republicans, but also hews closely to how Orthodox groups describe their position on abortion, reflecting a membership in which all religious streams are represented. Reproductive health choices based on full and accurate medical information and guidance must be in accordance with a woman's own religious, moral, and ethical values, a handout states. The group's core mission remains to raise funds for the two Jewish hospitals bearing its name. Again, its pitches are tailored to the younger Jewish women Hadassah hopes to attract. Hospitals remain a nexus of Jewish-Palestinian coexistence in an environment where that is increasingly rare. And that's an aspect the organization stresses in its U.S. outreach. Hadassah's Israel-based podcast, The Branch, has as its focus what it terms Israel's shared society. Hadass says it's on the right track after a financial crisis at the once private hospitals led to a restructuring plan supervised by Israel's finance ministry. Hadass is partnering as well with the former Jewish Women's Renaissance Project in a heavily subsidized year-long program called Momentum, formerly Birthright for Moms. The program, which is designed to connect Jewish families to Jewish tradition in Israel, includes 8 days in Israel. Also emphasized are Hadassah's breast cancer research for an Ashkenazi Jewish population at slightly higher risk, and infertility treatment for a demographic heavy with professional women who are likelier to wait until their mid to late 30s to start families. The new Hadassah member is younger and wants a professional networking element attached to her extracurricular activities. Hadassah now boasts affinity groups for physicians, nurses, and lawyers who meet and are likely to exchange information about their fields, including innovations and job opportunities, as they are to raise money for Israel. Weinman said that membership, including female members and male associates, has fallen to a 300,000 from a peak of 358,000 in 1986 and 7. It's gone down not because we've not maintained the level of membership, but because of attrition. We are not making up in the same number those who have died. Programs are now shorter, Weinman said, to accommodate busier women and include a transactional element. There's less of an extended commitment the way Hadassah members in the past have made, she said. Today's Hadassah meetings are pitched as benefiting members as much as they are opportunities for giving. Although Weinman is quick to point out, they're not frivolous. They choose their subject from a generic or ideological perspective, but personal. What affects their families and futures? How do they network? Hadassah's unwitting role in Madoff's Ponzi scheme, the worst in U.S. history, remains a sore point. An official half-jokingly warned a reporter not to mention his name ahead of the Weinman interview. Hadassah scaled back operations after the scandal blew open in late 2008 and eventually shut its Washington office, among other measures. In 2011, Hadassah returned $65 million to other investors, just under half its earnings under the fraudulent scheme, which paid early investors from money garnered from more recent investors instead of from actual earnings on the investments. Madoff was sentenced to 150 years in prison for his crimes. Jewish lawmakers from both parties told GTA they were pleased to see Hadassah back in business. Its advocacy is unmatched, and it's an honor to work with its members on important legislation, such as Never Again Education Act, to combat anti-Semitism through Holocaust education, and the Peace and Tolerance in Palestinian Education Act, bipartisan legislation I introduced with Brad Sherman, so said Representative Lee Zeldin, a Republican from New York. Senator Jackie Rosen, Democrat of Nevada, lead sponsor of the Never Again Act in the Senate, told Jewish Telegraphic Agency, I'm working with faith-based organizations like Hadassah on important policies like Newer Education Act because we must educate our students on the important lessons of the Holocaust. And speaking, having heard from a couple of elected representatives there, there is, at this point, only one Jewish candidate who has made the next Democratic debate. Wednesday night marked the deadline to qualify for the next Democratic presidential debate, and several hopefuls didn't make the cut. The only remaining Jewish candidate in the debates is Senator Bernie Sanders. Author Marianne Williamson, who has cited Torah on the campaign trail and became a hit on social media, failed to hit either of the other requirements, polling at the minimum 2% of the vote and securing 130,000 unique donors. Senator Michael Bennet, born to a Holocaust survivor mother, but who does not identify as Jewish, also failed to qualify. Senator Cory Booker, who frequently shows off his Hebrew, did pass the threshold. The biggest name to drop out of the race before next month's debate in Houston was Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York. Let's take a look at this week's Parsha. It is Re'im. It is Deuteronomy 11:26 through 16:17. Behold, I present before you today a blessing and a curse. The blessing when you internalize, when you heed the commands of the Lord your God, and a curse if you do not. Two problems face us as we read these verses. One's textual and the other existential. The textual issue is based on the lack of parallelism. The blessing when asher, you internalize, the curse if, im, you do not internalize. We would expect to find parallel consistency either when, or if you do not, in both instances. The existential issue hits us hard, especially in Israel during these fateful but difficult times. Our cemeteries are filled with children who have been buried by their parents, either soldiers in the line of battle or innocent victims at home, at school, at a bus stop, who were targeted by inhuman suicide bombers. Many, if not most of these, were our best, our brightest, and our most deserving of reward in accordance with the opening verses of our Torah portion. How, then, can we possibly explain the many instances of suffering and pain on the part of so many virtuous souls who certainly internalized the commandments of God? I believe that the precise biblical language reveals a profound truth about Torah commandments in human affairs. After all, the Torah iterates and reiterates that the Almighty gave us His laws for your good. Proper ethical conduct ensures a well-ordered social structure devoid of aggression and of violence. The Sabbaths, festivals, and laws of ritual purity provide for a stable and intergenerational family nucleus, united by meaningful occasions of joy, study, and song. Hence, an immediate blessing always comes together with and precisely when we perform the commandment. The reward for a commandment is the very fulfillment of the commandment, built in. In the instance of transgressions, there's also a built-in punishment. Evil bears bitter fruit. The sinner is eventually discovered. Unfaithfulness and deception destroy relationships and undermine families. However, unlike the blessing, the built-in curse is often not experienced until later on, sometimes not until the last years of the life of the transgressor. Hence, the adverb used by the Torah is not when, which connotes immediacy, but rather, if you do not internalize the commandments, then the curse will come, but not necessarily right away. Although this is the ultimate truth regarding the immediate reward of the mitzvah and the eventual punishment of the transgression, the accompanying emotion when doing the one or the other may be quite different, even opposite. The great Hasidic sage known as Shpul Etzede explained that the most fundamental lesson of all is the ability to distinguish between the good deed and the transgression, to overcome the evil impulse by embracing the former and distancing oneself from the latter. He tells how, as a child, he would go to the Schwitz, the steam bath, the European version, much larger and more vigorous than our contemporary sauna. He would go to the Schwitz with his father, who would pour out a small bucket of freezing water on him just as he would begin to perspire profusely. Ooh, he would inadvertently scream as the cold water contacted his burning hot flesh. But, after cooling down a bit, he would exclaim happily, "Ah! I myself had the same experience as a child attending the 10th Street Baths on the Lower East Side every Thursday evening with my father and grandfather. May their souls rest in peace. Remember, my child, the lesson of the ooh and the ah, the shpoy would hear from his father. Before and even during the commission of a transgression, you have a physical enjoyment, ah, but afterwards you ponder your sin and suffer its consequences, oh. In the case of a mitzvah, however, you might cry, ooh, when you have to get up early for prayers or for a lesson of Daf Yomi. But after the fact, and in reflection of your religious accomplishment, you will always exclaim, ah, afterwards. Make sure you conclude your life with an ah and not an ooh. The underlying assumption of this interpretation is that aside from the natural cause and effect of our actions, the Almighty does not extrinsically reward the righteous or punish the sinner in this world. One does not have the right to expect that if one is an honest businessman, one will be guaranteed great profits, or that if one observes the Sabbath, one will live a long and healthy life. This world, according to many of our Talmudic sages, is a world of freedom of choice for every individual. If the righteous would consistently be rewarded with long life, good health, and a large bank account, and the sinners would die at an early age in poverty, choosing to follow the commandments would be a no-brainer. Free choice precludes extrinsic rewards. Free choice also means that an individual can choose to be something which the Almighty does not desire. This world is largely a result of human action and natural happenstance. There is no extrinsic reward for the commandments in this world. That you'll find that in Tractate Kiddushin 39b in the Talmud. Indeed, the only guarantee that the Almighty makes is the eternity of the Jewish people. Israel will never be destroyed. We are assured of our return to our ancestral homeland, no matter how long or arduous the exile or the eventual perfection of human society. As far as everything else is concerned, not on individual merit does the length of one's life, the number and quality of one's children, and the extent of one's sustenance depend, but rather on luck, on mazel, do those things that depend. We also believe in the reality of the human soul, the portion of God from on high, which resides within every one of us created in the divine image. Just as God is indestructible, so is the soul indestructible. The physical dimension of our beings may pass away at the end of our lifetimes, but the soul, our spiritual essence, which emanates from the divine, lives eternally. To the extent that we develop our spiritual selves in our lifetimes, in deed and in thought, we prepare ourselves for a continued eternal life in the dimension of the divine. Shabbat Shalom from Rabbi Shlomo Riskin, Chancellor Emeritus of Or Torah Stone and Chief Rabbi of Ephrat Israel. We spoke earlier of politics in Washington. Here's something regarding to the coming Israeli elections. Dateline Jerusalem. Russian hackers struck the cell phone of Benny Gantz, the chief rival to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, in what an intelligence firm called an unprecedented attack. CGI Group, which Gantz hired to investigate a series of leaks from the center-left Blue and White Party, said no sensitive information was gleaned from the phone of the former Israeli military chief of staff. Blue and White played down the report, Israel's Channel 12 News reported on Wednesday. CGI said it was a powerful and unprecedented attack by Russian hackers, a type we have never before encountered. The hackers also compromised the phone of the party's chief of staff and campaign manager, as well as an advisor. In addition, the party's computer network was infiltrated, according to the report. CGI recommended the Blue and White file a police complaint, which was not done immediately. In March, prior to the April national elections, the Israel Security Agency, Shin Bet, informed Gantz's cell phone had been hacked 5 weeks earlier by Iranian intelligence. Gantz said the report had been purposely leaked close to the election to damage his chances. And in a follow-up story, the Russian embassy in Tel Aviv has denied that Russians are behind the hacking of Gantz's phone. Gantz called the finding a political attack. CGI Group, which he hired to investigate a series of leaks, said it was a powerful and unprecedented attack by Russian hackers. Gantz told Army Radio that there was no Russian hack of his cell phone, the cell phones of other party officials, and the party's computer system. He told Army Radio, "There are more than a few political figures who are trying to harm us. I don't want to think that the Russians are acting against us, and I don't want to think that there is an entity here that is activating them against us, and there are no findings to support that." Gantz said the report did not point to Russian involvement, accused CGI of not doing good work, and said another company had been hired to check its work and found that there was no hack. Blue and White lawmaker Moshe Yaalon said proxies of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu were the ones listening to the phone calls of Blue and White party members, and said the Prime Minister leaked the CGI findings to make the party look bad. Meanwhile, Russian embassy spokesman Alexander Gavrilov called the accusation of Russian hacking fake news. CGI President Yaakov Peri said the report referred to hostile elements from Eastern Europe, but did not specifically reference Russia. He said Blue and White also hired his company to dig up dirt on its rivals. And speaking of that election, from the Jewish News Service, Jewish News Syndicate, only 61% of Israelis plan to vote in September. Voter turnout in Israel's September 17th election may be very low, according to a new Israel Hayom I-24 News poll, sparking concern among the various political parties. Segmenting the results of the respondents' stated political affiliation, the survey found that only 65% of Likud voters plan to vote, cast their ballots on September 17th. Blue and White could count on the support of 69% of its electorate, and the Joint Arab List would see 55% of its supporters arrive at the polls. Labor Gesher would see greater as 82% plan to vote, followed by United Torah Judaism at 74%, Yamina, formerly the United Right, with 62%, Israel Beitenu at 68%, the Democratic Union 74%, Shaz 62%, Zahut 73%, and the radical Utzma Yehudit, which can count on 69% of its supporters. On the other hand, Zehut and Otzma Yehudit are not expected to pass the 3.25%, the four-seat electoral threshold. The poll, conducted by Magar Mohot Institute under Professor Yitzhak Katz, polled 611 people and has a margin error of 4%. Alarmed by the data, the various parties are planning to mobilize voters in various ways. Likud insiders said the party will have twice as many activists on the ground come election day who will contact registered voters and convince them to go to the polling stations. Blue and White is reportedly working on a special mobile application that would help the party monitor its members' voting rate. The plan also plans to double its efforts on the ground. Yamina plans on recruiting thousands of activists to help with both an awareness campaign and highlighting the importance of voting. Israel Beiteinu did not have anything to say about it. The Sackler family of opioid fame is planning to give up ownership of Purdue Pharma. From the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, the Sackler family would give up ownership of Purdue Pharma and pay $3 billion of its own money to settle thousands of state and federal lawsuits over its role in fueling the nation's opioid epidemic. The settlement, according to a tentative negotiated agreement described to NBC and the New York Times, would be worth between $10 and $12 billion. The prescription painkiller OxyContin, produced by Purdue in 1996, helped make Sacklers America's 19th richest family with a combined net worth of $13 billion. The company has been accused of aggressively marketing the powerful and addictive painkiller, even as it became clear that drugs weren't safe as advertised. At least 22 states have filed lawsuits against Purdue. The settlement would require the company to restructure under a Chapter 11 bankruptcy filing, which would turn the private company into a public beneficiary trust, allowing the profits from all drug sales, including OxyContin, to go to the plaintiffs of the lawsuits. The company would also agree to give its addiction treatment drugs free to the public. Those drugs are currently under development. The company said in a statement emailed to NBC, which first reported the settlement and the Times, while Purdue Pharma is prepared to defend itself vigorously in opioid litigation, the company has made clear that it sees little good coming from years of wasteful litigation and appeals. The people and communities affected by the opioid crisis need help now. Purdue believes a constructive global resolution is the best path forward, and the company is actively working with the state attorneys general and other plaintiffs to achieve this outcome. News of the proposed settlement comes a day after an Oklahoma state judge ordered Johnson & Johnson to pay $572 million for its part in the state's opioid crisis. Oklahoma reached a $270 million settlement with Purdue Pharma and $85 million settlement with Israel-based Teva Pharmaceutical. Let's look at the calendar. Sunday, this coming Sunday, September 1st, 10 a.m. to noon, Grandparents' Day at Northern Hills Synagogue, and on Monday, Wise Center is having Yofi Monday Fun Day. That'll be on Labor Day, 9 to 11 a.m. at Ziegler Park. Shabbat candles light tonight at 7:52, and Shabbat will end at 8:51 on Saturday. This has been the American Israelite Program. I'm Malcolm Bernstein. Have a good Shabbat.